where we have a control field I sub d, and we wrote down the qubit. And what we found was that we ended up having a parabolic potential. So if I write out the potential as a function of the phase difference across the JJ. So this is the phase difference. So we ended up with this parabolic term, which basically, well, let's write down the potential. I keep doing that. All right, so we have this parabolic potential that depends upon the inductance of the system. We've got a periodic potential that depends upon a critical current. So on top of this, we can put some cosine function for that. And then we have a tilt of this potential that's under our control, right? This we can change. And as we look to remember that we ended up wanting to have this parabolic potential because we wanted to have a qubit that was localized in the phase difference. So we wanted a place where we could operate where there was truly a lowest energy in the system. And when we look at this, we can control IC by the quality of the junction that we make. Okay, so that's material science. We can control the strength of the periodic potential by varying this inductance. And you can see what we want to do is we want that inductance to be small. So I want this ring to be small. The bigger the ring is, the less important it is. And the tilt, well, that has these two terms. One, of course, the current that we actually put through there, and then the fraction of the current that goes through here. So that we have alpha times L and 1 minus alpha times L. So alpha is some fraction of 1, right? It's the splitting of the inductance over that ring. Okay. And then to treat this as a qubit, we said, oh, if we take our parameter ID and we set this equal to 0, and by 0 here, I don't mean for certain choice of parameters, to have this system where there's no tilt, ID might actually not be 0, right? But conceptually here, we want this non-tilted piece. And so we'll just imagine that we can call that 0. And of course, if we take ID not equal to 0, we can have a tilted double well potential. And what did we say? We said that we wanted to use this state as the computational basis, because if I put us in this tilted potential, then we could cool to this ground state here. So we call this psi 0, the ground state. And I'm going to associate this with sigma z. Okay, so we're going to call this the operation under this, a sigma z operation. It's interesting in the superconducting literature, depending upon how people came to a particular qubit, some people quantize in Z and some quantize in X. And of course, the Pauli operator doesn't care what you use for labels, but it makes it, just that much more tricky to read the literature. But the argument for why I want this to be Z is not only that we can see that there's a ground state here that's local to this, but more that if I think of this as the ground state, and let's take that state as the first excited state of that potential, then there's an energy difference between these. And so if I had a superposition and I turned on this operation, then we would pick up a phase of those. And so that's the operation of a sigma z. Okay, so that's why I like this to be sigma z. And you can see that we've now made some requirements here. We said, oh, I would like to set those parameters so that those are the first two excited states. Okay? It's not required, but if we're going to have a fiction here, I'll choose my fiction. And then if I look at this operation, we'll take the ground state, psi zero, so we'll call that z. We'll call that z. And take psi zero, and we're going to associate this with an x operation. And so this will have pretty bad. Well, the zero state will look like that. And the first excited state, I don't have any other colored chalk, will look like this. Okay, and so now that we have a way of creating a sigma x operation, because if I am here in this well, in this state, and I diabatically, so I instantaneously jump up to here, then I'm going to create a superposition between these two. When I create a superposition between those two, then they're going to evolve in time. And if I wait for the right time, I would end up over in this well, and then I could come back. And so you say, yes, we have a sigma x operation over this. And so just by jumping between these things, we have all the operations we need. Now there's a requirement, and let's remind ourselves of this, that we're asking that sigma zero of z, sigma, let's just say two, so this is psi one of x, psi two of x, I want that to be zero. And of course, I would like the overlap to be zero for all values of this operator that are not, or all values of that state that are not zero and one. Okay? That's just a requirement for us to put in there. Okay. I'll save myself some room right here. So, what do we have now? We look at the requirements for a quantum computer. So, David DeVincenzo's requirements. So, we have a physical mapping. And the most simplistic way to talk about this mapping is that we map phi into a qubit, thinking that as we jump from this state, this basis state, to this basis state, what we're changing is the expectation value of the phase across the JJ, right? So then, in a simple language, we can say that the qubit is defined by phi. We want to be able to prepare a state No problem for us so far. We say, oh, there's an energy difference. If I cool enough, I end up there. So we can cool to the ground state and see. All right. Three. Universal control. Well, clearly we have that too. If we can jump from a Z operator to an X operator, then of course the commutation of those two gives us a Y operator. And so if we have for one qubit X, Y, and Z, we have universal control. So yes, we have this. We can measure because we can tilt the well further until really locally that this parabolic dependence vanishes. And what we'll see is that we'll run down. So we'll get a voltage. So we can go to high IDC and we'll see a voltage that tells us the state. So we have universal control, meaning we have a measurement, sorry. And then the last. Decoherence. So we don't know because we didn't put it in the model, right? And so it's easy to say, oh, my model doesn't have decoherence, it's perfect. We might ask more of each other. So there's a bunch of anticipated noise sources. And with some effort, we can calculate the sensitivity to them, though I won't. Flux noise in this ring, right? We saw that's when we defined the phase jump across the Josephson junction, that it depended upon the flux in this ring. So if we have flux noise in the ring, so there's a stray magnetic field, then that's going to lead to noise. There's noise in the current bias. Anytime you rely upon a classical control element, then there has to be noise, and there will be in this case too. So we try to avoid that, but it'll be there. And there'll be noise from the materials. There'll be noise because we have quasiparticles in our junction. There'll be noise because somewhere there'll be a charge that jumps around. And those things are easy to see experimentally, hard to control. And material science as a whole is a difficult field still. I mean, people can do very beautiful things, but still it's an important limitation. Now that's not everything, right? Because there's a bunch of imperfections. And basically, these are things that we had to design in. It depends on how well we did it. This is maybe the most important one right here that says, hey, maybe this overlap isn't zero. So as I go between those, I'm going to populate some higher state. Now that's a unitary dynamic. And so you would say, oh, well, potentially I could refocus that, right? I could do something later that would remove the effect of this because I haven't actually lost information, provided I have control over this level as well, right? And so the imperfections need not lead us to irrecoverable loss of information, but they do put in additional constraints in how we prepare our system. Okay, so now then we have one qubit. And one qubit's not very interesting. I mean, we might spend years, we do spend years working on one qubit system. But if you're a computer scientist, you're not going to get much interest from them on this. So let's talk about two qubits. And there are lots and lots of ways of doing this. And I just want to show you a simple approach where we don't have to introduce any new physics. There's many, many approaches where you would introduce new physics. But let's not do that for now. So what we're going to do, is we'll take two of these junctions. All right, so there's one. And I'm going to capacitively couple them. And the way I want to capacitively couple them is here. Because remember that the current through this, so let's call this C couple. So that I couple is equal to C dV dt. But that's, of course, the voltage across this. So if I couple them, I'm going to couple them in such a way that there'll be the voltage difference across the junctions. The reason I want the voltage difference across the junctions is, of course, the voltage difference is giving us immediately phi, right? So that d phi dt is equal to the voltage, right? That was Josephson's second rule. So we immediately have some nice physics that we can couple into. All right, so let's draw this. And it's sufficient that what we do is have two identical junctions. So I don't need, in fact, to have control to make any of the parameters in the individual junctions different. We can use exactly the same parameters. But I will give myself the flexibility of having two different current sources. Okay. Good. So we have device one, device two. We've capacitively coupled them so that I couple is equal to C couple D V one minus D V two. Okay, so now we have a simple piece where these things, V1 is going to be Now, of course, let's look at the expression. We'll take the current to be going this way. So when we look at, I actually didn't write it down. When we look at the differential equation for each side, just write it down for the first one. Okay, so that's what we had originally. If I leave off this capacitor, right? And now I want to add to that current that will have the coupling capacitor, H bar over 2E again, d phi 1 dt minus the second derivative, phi 2 dt. Right, so that's the term that's going to couple those two. And so now we see what happens. That effectively, the state of the second qubit, or the phase difference between those two, really, I should say, the change in voltage difference between those two, is going to change the tilt of this device. And of course, it was the tilt that was giving us the operator. Okay, so this is a good thing. It says yes. So if I look at qubit one, there is a the tilt of the potential that depends on the voltage difference between the two. So it depends on the voltage, the change in voltage over two. So when we look at this, not good. We can write out both equations. That's easy. I'm not going to do it for you. We can look at the change in the potential here. And you see what happens is that if I take the change in potential of the x basis, right, those two levels are uniform, and we're either going to change them a little bit this way or a little bit this way, depending upon what the state of the other one is. And they're always going to go the same way between both wells. Because remember here that although I've chosen the sign of this piece, you know, so the current is going to be added this way, it's going to be subtracted this way, meaning that I can add it and change the order of those two. Right? So the sigma x term is always going to come in the same. So this piece is going to give us a Hamiltonian that has a sigma x1, sigma x2 dependence minus a sigma z1, sigma z2 dependence. And so the Hamiltonian has that nice structure. Now, if you like, you can take this and show that this again looks like this raising, lowering operator, but quantized in the y basis. right? I can write the raising and lowering operators in any basis I like. Just take a similarity transform from their normal definition. And if I transform into the Y basis and look at this exchange operator, then it has that nice form. And so that's good. It says, yes, this is going to give us something that we like. It's going to allow us to exchange information from the qubit, from the left to right-hand side of the qubit. Now, we have an important question, two important questions. Does this give us universality? And what control operations do we need to get universality? So it's really tempting to say, oh, well, you know, what I want to do is I want to make this thing time dependent. I want to put a knob here so I can control this. So I could have two isolated qubits or I could have two coupled qubits. And we can do that. And then, of course, you know, we take the capacitor to zero. Life is good. We would then have this piece. It's not a very clean solution. I'm not going to talk about it because I don't want to introduce the circuit elements that we would have to put here. But more importantly, it's not necessary. That if I have just the control elements written out here, I already have universal control. That there's nothing else I need to do. So let's look quickly at that. Okay, so there's our qubit. So we're going to say that the capacitor is always there. So if the capacitor is always there, then we have a Hamiltonian which has some strength. Let's just call it J for a coupling strength, sigma x minus sigma z, 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay, that's always on. And then we have the single qubit control operations, right? And those we could think about remember that we've set up that qubit so that we are allowing only two states of the bias current. So that the bias current is jumping quickly between only two different states. So in one state, we would have sigma x here, and of course we could choose to have the same one there, or we could have sigma z, or we could have sigma z and sigma x. Right, we have to have those four choices. But it's worthwhile remembering what these are. That these are terms in the Hamiltonian, so that if I forgot about the coupling term, the Hamiltonian for this would be some frequency, let's call it x, sigma x identity, 1, 2, plus some frequency, the same frequency x, identity 1, sigma x 2, right? It's those two operators acting on the other two qubits, on their individual qubits, irrespective of what's going on the other one. And let's write down the next one. The Hamiltonian for the next would be omega x sigma x1 identity 2 plus omega z identity 1 sigma x2. And omega x and omega z, well, these are not the same, right? Let's go back and look at that first word again. The strength of sigma z is that energy separation, right? So I have an energy separation here. Let's call it E sub z, right? And so the strength of that is going to be E divided by H bar, right? So omega Z is equal to EZ divided by H bar. I'm not sure whether I use subscripts or superscripts, but you'll figure it out. Remember in the sigma X piece, right? That we jumped from a Z quantization to an X quantization, and it was the energy difference between the first two states that's going to lead to a precessional term, right? So, omega X is equal to the separation energy of the first two eigenstates under the X basis divided by H bar. And so those two, I mean, we have control over them by how we choose our Hamiltonian, how we fabricate our system. But we wouldn't expect them to be equal, okay? And it wouldn't be a good thing if they were equal. So we have that control, we'll use it. All right. So now then we say, I've got four different Hamiltonians that we're looking at. So we can call this XX, XZ, ZX, and ZZ, right? And so we're going to add to this one of those. So we have our coupling Hamiltonian. So our total Hamiltonian is equal to HJ plus HIJ. Choose one of those four combinations. And now if I want to know if I have universal control, what I want to do is to look at the commutation relationships of these and ask, do I create the full algebra? And that's pretty easy to see, right? Because if the frequency difference is, that should be a Z. If the frequency differences are different here, then fine, if I apply that to here, I'll take, you know, if I have sigma X, sigma Z, then, you know, this term is going to go to Y, and this term is going to go to Y, right? And we can just keep looking at these commutations. And it's also relatively easy to show that that you can drive this term to zero so that I can apply a series of these operations. And on average over time, this Hamiltonian will effectively go to zero. You can see that trivially, all I need to do is to apply a pi pulse about the y-axis on one of the qubits. If I apply a pi pulse about the y-axis, one of the qubits, and the y-axis isn't one of our control elements, but if I rotate about x by 90 degrees and then a pi pulse about z and then x by minus 90 degrees, then I've implemented that operation. So we have universal control. Now, let's ask what this control looks like. So we had for one qubit, sigma x, and we had sigma z. And now what's going to happen is we'll have sigma x e plus on the other one. So remember that the e plus and minus our projectors or idempotents. Okay. And so it just selects out the plus state of this. And so under this piece, we'll have some slight tilt of these. And sigma x e minus will be a slight tilt in the other direction. And the same thing, we can talk about sigma z e plus and sigma z e minus as, now it's harder to see, right? But it's small changes up and down of those two potentials. So the only control we have in our qubits is this tilt, and this operator is just putting a conditional tilt. So it says that, hey, the rate of phase evolution for the z rotation depends upon the state of the other qubit, right? That's all this says. And so therefore, we can get a conditional gate. And because it has this nice particular form, we see that the rate of phase evolution in these cases also has that structure. Now notice what happens. That we had this requirement that for the excited states, we weren't going to overlap with them, right? That if we're going to live in this qubit space, right, we have all of these energy levels in the system. And we say, oh, no, I'm just taking a few. And they're the special ones when you use them for the qubits. And so now then we have a further requirement that under all of these potentials, we shouldn't be overlapping the excited states as well. Okay, so we build in, as we build in more control elements, we build in more constraints in how we actually build the system. But we can do that. And, you know, it's again, yeah. In the Z basis, yeah, just, right? Yep. Okay. So now then, we've got universal control. We have universal control over two qubits. We have a bigger set of requirements for this. In the particular system we have, we leave the coupling on all the time, but we can apply a control sequence to suppress it. We have this nice so-called bang-bang control that says we're instantly jumping between two states. We never allow anything in between. And by adding... By adding this capacitor, what we've done is to add additional noise sources and go back to your diagram and add that wire. Because if I want to add a current, you know, the current has to flow somewhere. So I should have had this wire there. Okay. So now that you can see that we've added additional noise sources as well, that we said, oh, there can be flux noise in this loop. And when we were talking about a single qubit, and that flux noise would lead to decoherence. And of course, it could be in this loop. But now we see, oh, no, it can be in this loop too. And the argument, again, will be that oh, we'll make that loop big enough that no flux noise is going to be interesting, right? Because remember that the sensitivity goes as 1 over the inductance, right? So we say, it's okay. We'll make it big enough. Only these things will be small and high energy. That will be large and low energy. Of course, we've added a capacitor, and so we've added more opportunities for charge noise to enter in. And of course, we've added a bunch of material and the rest of it. But okay, that's what we get. All of this, you know. All of that, you know. Good. Okay, so this gets us to having two qubits in a controlled system, in a controlled fashion. And it nicely, it doesn't require any more control lines, right? We have one control line per qubit, and we can do this. That's hard to maintain as we go up in a number of qubits. You can see that if I said, okay, there's the first two, add a third qubit, right? And so now then you say, oh, maybe I'm going to couple another one in here, right? And I'll try to have a linear array. But that wouldn't be a good thing because we know that we can't get quantum information processing. We can't get quantum efficiencies out of a linear array. You can say, oh, maybe I can have a ladder structure and I'll put capacitors here and then I'll put capacitors there and I'll make a two-dimensional structure. And therefore, I'll be able to get universality. And it starts to get a little bit closer to something that one could imagine, but still it's going to become a forest of things. And there's an open question today in quantum information processing that we're struggling with related to this. The most important question is, how do you get entropy out of your system in parallel when your state is close to an arbitrary encoded state? If you want to get entropy out in parallel when you're preparing the ground state, the fiducial state, the state you start off with all zeros, that often is easy for a given implementation. But it's not enough. You can't take entropy out at the beginning and entropy out at the end and have an effective computation. You need to find a way of getting entropy out efficiently and in parallel over the whole process. And therefore, you need to be able to get entropy out for, as you were talking with Dan, for some arbitrary state that's close to being in the encoded basis, right? And we don't know how to do that. And so the structures that we think of are limited by how do we solve that problem, right? They're not limited by how do I get enough current lines in there to control the system. That's also a hard problem, but that's not the hardest problem. Now there's an approach to this that's very popular that people are looking at, is to take a superconducting strip line. So let's just take a wire of superconductor and put two capacitors here. So this break in the wire, right? This is the superconductor. That's just some dielectric that we're looking at. And this, of course, defines the node of the electric field. And so now if I looked at the electric field, the lowest mode of the electric field looks like that. And so now then we say, oh yes, I have a resonant structure, okay, at this particular frequency over the device. And of course, it's periodic, right? I mean, there's another one there, and we can keep adding these up. So we can say, oh yes, we can make a resonator that has a high magnetic field here, okay, a high electric field here. And we can make this as a very precise, very carefully tuned frequency. Then we can come back here and we can say, if I'm coupling to this qubit, then I know that I can couple into this with a microwave field that separates the first two transitions of the Z level. Okay, so that energy separation I can couple in also with the microwave field. And so then we can imagine saying, oh, let's put a set of our qubits in here. And then by bringing them in and out of resonance with this structure, we could couple them or not. And remember when we were talking about that, we said, oh, this looks like, if I lose that, this looks like a driven pendulum. And if I leave this in, it looks like a driven coupled set of pendulum. Okay? If I leave it out and put them there, then again, it looks like a driven coupled set of pendulum where the coupling term is how close to being on resonance are each of these individually with this structure here. And so we're not going to, certainly not going to go over and talk about the physics of this, but we can develop these ideas of saying that effectively there's a virtual exchange of photons between these two devices. And so with that virtual exchange of photons, we can couple any of these, right? That this coupling would be as strong as that coupling would be as strong as that coupling. Truly could be a two-dimensional system. So there's just lots of ways forward for these things. They're still incredibly noisy, very, very fragile. And we have a hard time building a device that operates exactly as we thought it was going to operate when we simulated it. But all those things are getting better. Okay, so unfortunately, this is the end of the class. For the superconducting stuff, what I wanted you to get out of this is that the exploration of quantum mechanics is no longer the case that we're passively observing how quantum mechanics acts in nature. That now we can build a structure to explore quantum mechanics exactly as we would like it to be. And the excitement today often revolves around mapping these into two quantum computers. But there's an even richer history of these devices, mapping them onto condensed matter structures. And so Hans Moy, many years ago, took a number of such structures, combined them in a line, and used those to model the Mott transition to ask, could he see falling into, for a 1D system, into effective Mott transition? And you could do that. So there's this, whether you're building structures because you want to understand some condensed matter physics, or you're building structures to solve a problem, or you're building structures because you want a better sensor, or you're building structures because you want to have an actuator for building other nano pieces, all of those things, we can engineer, control, build at the level of a quantum device. And by and large, they work as they should. And of course, these things get so complicated that you need the tools that Dan taught you for looking at quantum information science. If you try to understand these devices simply by simulating the dynamics of these coupled differential equations, if you looked at that particular dynamic, it's incredibly complicated. And what will happen is you'll see that the voltages between these two, if you just let it run, will jump. And they'll jump at what it looks like random points between number of flux quanta stored in this loop. And so you don't want to do that. What you want to do is really bring the power of quantum information. And as you do that, you have to remember that when you make these mappings onto systems, you're giving a promise. You're saying that your experiment will respect those mappings, that your experiment will live in the part of the Hilbert space that you've modeled and won't go somewhere else. And so you're saying, oh yes, if I make this particular mapping, if I limit myself to these particular subspaces or subsystems, then I'm going to get a simple dynamic. And this is the design that the constraints that I need to put into place so that that is in fact true. Now, of course, we looked earlier at other systems, the neutron interferometer, just to have, you know, a really clean quantum system that we could understand everything about. And the, you know, the surprise there was that even in such a clean system, we could learn new things and we could find new applications. So again, quantum information science brings new ideas to the old ideas of using interferometry as a precise measurement, something that has been done for 150 years, and yet there's still room to learn things. And we looked at the diamond system. You know, the superconducting system we just got through looking at, presumably for a long time, is going to be restricted to being in dilution refrigerators. And, you know, it's going to be a laboratory scale process. You know, there are high T superconductors, but it's just very hard to imagine that you could get these things out of the lab. You know, there needs to be some new material science and physics. So who knows when those things happen. But the diamond system works at room temperature. It's incredibly robust. You saw it yesterday, how compact it is. It really could be very, very compact. And there is a system that you can take out to the lab and you can use for exploring other things. I mean, it might be some of the initial explorations are to take that system and use it to image biochemical systems. And so, you know, it might be that what really happens is you take it out of the physics lab and you enable the biochemist to use it without having to know all the physics. We'll say, oh yeah, that's out of our lab anyways, right? And it would be an incredibly useful tool for those folks. And so yes, that we would be happy with that. And of course, you know, there are applications that you could say it's even further. You know, the high-tech applications to environmental monitoring. There you could imagine getting it out into a further group of people. I don't know what the first application will be, you know, where it's, you have a quantum device sold at Walmart, but I'll leave that for your imagination. Okay, so that's the full story. You get to ask your questions. No questions.